Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In today's episode, we explore evidence of that fleeting time when the worker was king. We try to dodge concrete death, and we find out how to make a middle-aged decorator vomit. It's the 26th of September 2014. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. This is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sounds you ain't never seen the like before. Just a stone's throw from your front door.
Misgivings, listener, about today's episode. Sometimes you have to weigh up the signs that you see. And the first sign I saw as I arrived in the area in which I now stand was a large one by the roadside saying, avoid this area. I don't know why it said that. We're now going to do a topsy-turvy manoeuvre. We're going to attempt an overview of today's subject, and then we're going to go what looks like about 30 stories up in the air, having done the overview from on the ground. This will all make sense. With me today is Joe Watson from the National Trust. And, well, it's not a very lovely place, to be quite honest, that we find ourselves today. I think normally, Joe, when people think the National Trust, we think a lot of rural stuff or stately homes. There tends to be a sense of wealth, whether present wealth or past wealth, about it. And we're in amongst building works aplenty. It's a reasonably run-down, certainly an area in need of a lot of TLC.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair enough assessment, but I hope by the end of the programme to have challenged some of your perceptions of why we're here and indeed of the beauty of this place. There's a bit of an underlying beauty going on that I think is really rather important and particularly relevant to the National Trust.
Now, listeners who've been with the show for some time will, of course, remember your name and voice from the... well, almost the companion location in London. We were up in Hampstead looking at the House of Goldfinger, the architect. Oh, no, Goldfinger, the architect, made famous, I think, in a way he probably wouldn't have approved of by Ian Fleming. And it is he who brings us to this part of East London. We're in the Poplar All Saints Langdon Park area, and we're looking up at tower blocks.
That's right, we are. We're here standing really between Carradale, Glencairry and Balfron Towers, all of which are named after Scottish villages, but in fact were all designed by Erno Goldfinger and his office, really between 1965 and about 1978. So that's what brings us here. We've skipped forward a few decades. Of course, Tuvalu Road was designed in the mid-30s and completed in 1939. So we're really now looking at architecture of the mid to late 60s, which is rather different.
We've said plenty of times on this show that that period is most notable, most notorious maybe, for brutalist architecture, of which a lot has fallen into disfavour, I would say. We think particularly of some of the buildings down in Elephant and Castle. The Barbican is always a little bit of a controversial architectural style. How does the architecture that we're going to look at today compare with some of that stuff?
Yeah, it's definitely brutalist. There's no question of that. What we're looking at is rough, raw concrete and towering buildings, which some would probably describe as monstrosities. I would probably point out their sublime features, but we can come onto that a little bit more later. I mean, I think a word really to start off, though, on brutalism, which is a much misunderstood word. People always think of brutalism as meaning that, you know, it's somehow to do with its brutalizing effect on the humans who lived in these buildings. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. It actually was a word that was expounded and discussed at great length by the design historian Rainer Banham. And its derivation is actually from béton brut, the French, which meant simply raw concrete.
Ah, right. That idea of rawness certainly makes sense. And they're very unapologetic structures, generally speaking, aren't they? I think I'm right in saying they don't really seek to mesh themselves in with their environment, and instead they're there to do a particular thing in a particular way, and they get on and do that.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I think I would always want to say that it's important not to slip into what you could call the Prince Charles fallacy of assuming that all buildings in any given area have to look exactly the same. This is heroic architecture, actually. This is architecture that is standing up to be counted.
It's got a whiff of the Soviet about it, in my view.
Yes. All right. Fair enough. And in fact, we had a journalist just the other day who accused it of being Stalinist architecture, as it should have been.
Well, yeah, you can certainly imagine the hammer and sickle design emblazoned 20 foot high on the side. We don't have that. But I must say, some of the buildings that I've spied today have really got some incredible shapes to them that I've not seen elsewhere. And we were looking at one particular tower that seems to be a fishbowl come cabin suspended, I've no idea how high up in the air, 20 stories maybe, and it looks really very unusual. It reminds me of the Beatles' Yellow Submarine video.
Yes, yeah, fair point. In fact, I mean, that particular design is Glen Kerry House, and it follows on from Trellick Tower, which is Goldfinger's most famous building, I think it's probably fair to say. It's actually the Balfron Tower, which is the building we're going to go into in just a moment. It's younger sister. So the Balfron was really the prototype for Trellick, and then for Carradale and for Glen Kerry, all of which followed.
So Goldfinger was, I presume, commissioned and given how much of a free hand in what he did in this area?
Well, a reasonably free hand. I mean, as with any council architecture, it came with, you know, budgetary restrictions and all the rest of it. But what Goldfinger was definitely setting out to do here was to create and design buildings for the masses that brought a bit of the beauty of the design of his own home and of the best of architecture at that particular moment, you know, to the ordinary people.
So we're going to proceed up the Balfron Tower, as you say. Before we do, I think the only remaining item of business, perhaps, is to just map out exactly how much of the built environment here we owe to the vision of Goldfinger.
Yeah, so what we've got is one very large 27-storey building, which is the Balfron Tower itself. Next to that, a series of interlinked smaller towers, lower-rise towers, which are known as Carradale House. And then a smaller building again, which is Glen Kerry. And then along Rowlett Street, we've got a series of much lower-rise buildings, which Goldfinger originally intended to be lived in by people who'd retired.
So these are almshouses.
That's right. They are modern-day 1960s almshouses.
Well, let's move towards the Balfron Tower. Because I was coming to this for the first time, of course, first impressions can be very striking, and I won't have been taking in the fine detail, but what you do notice is this spine of connecting walkways. So there's one tower, which I think is the stairwell, perhaps the lift shafts, and then the bigger block next to it, as you say, 27 stories high, and that's where all the flats are. And then in between those, I guess every two or three floors, it looks like there are walkways across, and it strikes a very unusual sort of silhouette.
It certainly does, and Trellick, of course, is again, a slightly taller building, 31 stories. And that's really become the kind of iconic silhouette of a typical piece of Goldfinger architecture. But this was the prototype. And what you've got here is the service wing, the service tower that you just described, which includes the stairwell and it includes two lift shafts as well. And also, I mean, the reason he was doing that was to try and separate the really noisy bits of the building, if you like. It's also got things like the bin chutes in it. So it was trying to separate people away from all of that. And then what that allowed you to do in the main part of the building was to really open up the spaces so that what people get is a very light space. And when you look at these buildings, they are, you know, pretty much floor-to-ceiling glazed in all cases on one side, which gives you the most incredible experience of the view across London in different directions.
Yeah, that's one thing that very often strikes me about larger developments, larger residential developments, is tiny little windows. And I've been in one or two of those places, and you do feel confined.
We certainly do. We seem to be going a bit backwards in terms of architecture. And, of course, it's important to remember where we come from. Here we are in Poplar. This is an area that was really blitzed, sort of very badly so. And it's really then this post-war building, you know, creating a new... You get Festival of Britain architecture in the early 1950s. And then you get this moment of Goldfinger and this particular development, which is mid-60s, as I said earlier.
We are punching in the secret code and praying for admittance. You've got a Confederate.
I have got a Confederate up in the flat. She's letting us in.
We're going to be meeting the Confederate in just a moment. That period that you mentioned, Joe, between the festival and this 60s brutalist surge, did that represent some sort of change in materials and what was available?
It did, yes. I mean, concrete had been used earlier, and in fact there are some really amazing examples, particularly in France, of the use of concrete, you know, as early back as the 1920s. But there is definitely something that happens around materials, and I think there's also something that happens around utopianism and this kind of real drive to create really bold architecture, which I think is really interesting. I mean, this is something that we might go on to discuss more later, but thinking about that idea of heroic architecture and the way in which big architecture always shows you where the power is. Now, that power has lain variously with the church, and it's lain then with the aristocracy, and, of course, now it lies with big business and with banks and all the rest of it. There was a wonderful moment, a very important moment in the 1960s, where big architecture was social housing.
That truly is fascinating, isn't it? What on earth happened to that? It seems it could only have been fleeting.
Yeah, it was fairly fleeting. That was partly to do with changes in government. It's probably fair to say that Margaret Thatcher did not help. But there was a particular moment also where the establishment really did turn against this kind of architecture. Alice Coleman, who was a professor of the built environment, really started to shore up evidence against high-rise building and against this kind of architecture by doing quite big sociological studies. And there was, you know, it is fair to say that there was an element of truth to some of what she presented. But someone like Goldfinger would have argued that the reason for the decline was really around the fact that these buildings were not cared for as they could have been and should have been. They didn't have things like a concierge, which is exactly what he had intended there to be and had expected that there would be when he designed the buildings. So, very early on in the history of these buildings, you get issues around crime in the buildings and around anyone really being able to use the building because it was simply a publicly accessible space.
It sounds as though the knees were knocked out from under the scheme.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And so it really only takes a decade or so for people to be decrying buildings like this and, you know, particularly thinking of Trellick Tower, which is perhaps most famous for this and ends up being nicknamed the Tower of Terror.
Because?
because of the kind of crime that was going on, because of prostitution, because of you know, drug taking in the public spaces and public areas of those buildings. And so they became places that people didn't want to live. And then, of course, you end up with a kind of classic catch-22 that the people who are more articulate and perhaps would be the more responsible inhabitants of those kind of buildings managed to argue their way out of living in those buildings. And certainly we know that for many of the residents of places like Balfron and Trellick, it actually started to feel as though it was almost council policy. I mean, not quite, but almost council policy to be moving the problem people in. Because you got them in, you got them out of the way, you know, somewhat out of sight, and just kind of let them get on with it.
So ghettoisation, straight and simple.
Absolutely.
And it's remarkable, really, isn't it? Because, seriously, who wouldn't want a view like the one we've just discovered as we've come out now on the 24th floor in a lift? I've got to say, whose button numbering system leaves a lot to be understood. Not every floor and not any discernible pattern. But anyway, we're looking at now through one of these narrow slit windows down onto, I think we're looking west. I can see the Shard there. That doesn't really locate you in London, though, does it? The fact that you can see the Shard somewhere. We've got to our furthest left the buildings of Canary Wharf. And, well, every tall structure in London is visible to us from here. But the thing that I guess is extremely apparent from up here is that the sort of housing we've been talking about absolutely dominates this part of town.
Yeah, it does, absolutely. And what we've got beneath us is classic, you know, Festival of Britain, 1950s architecture, the amazing Crisp Street Market with Francis Gibbard's beautiful clock tower that he created. I mean, this whole area has a really interesting history. And what most people don't realise, you know, everyone knows about the Festival of Britain that happened on the South Bank, but they didn't realise that actually this was the architecture panel's contribution to the Festival of Britain, was creating this whole area, which they did, and they opened it in 1951 as part of the Festival of Britain. Of course, it didn't, unfortunately, get the level of visitors that the South Bank Centre saw, but it was an important statement about social housing. It was a very important statement for the East End as well, and really, you know, beginning to put places like Poplar on the map again and say, you know, we have to sort this out. We have to clear away the the bomb damage, but we have to clear away the Victorian slums as well. You know, we forget that people were living 27 stories below us. They were living in very dark, unpleasant conditions, vermin infested, you know, really, really unpleasant. And suddenly, this bold new vision, and here we are in the mid-1960s, and people who were not used to things like fitted bathrooms, they were not used necessarily to even having really good quality running water, were suddenly escorted into a building like this and literally elevated up into the light. They were given the most extraordinary views over London. They were given fitted kitchens, they were given fitted bathrooms, they were given heating, they were given all mod cons. This was a kind of really, really revolutionary moment in history in terms of architecture.
The other period, again in the East End actually, that resonates in my mind with this is the aftermath of the Great Fire, which was used as an excuse to rethink how things were done, what they were made of, and introduce a little more order and refinement into lives, or at least that was the ideal.
Absolutely, and of course Wren came up with these very grand plans for central London, many of which were not adopted. One of the interesting things about Goldfinger, although he didn't work on the County of London plan directly, and this is the plan that was created in 1941, aware of the damage that was already being done, the planners at the London County Council were busy coming up with post-war plans already, you know, as early as 1941. What Goldfinger was asked to do, though, was to create a public version of that, which is actually a beautiful Penguin book published in 1943, which in very kind of layman's terms described what it was that he was hoping to do, what you know, what the architectural profession wanted to do, how they wanted to bring beauty but also good quality design, good quality living to ordinary folk throughout London.
That's remarkable. We know, of course, Albrecht Speer and his visions for an architecture that was completely aligned with Nazi ideals, and it sounds as though we were firing a few shots back. The idea of being able to look forward, and publicly so, in 43 seems really very odd to the ear. We have to go and meet the person with the best name on the show for many an episode, Tilly Hemingway. Tilly's waiting for us in Goldfinger's flat here. She's buzzing us through. What is Tilly's role?
So Tilly is a designer working with Hemingway Design, perhaps her slightly more famous father, Wayne Hemingway, of Red or Dead and what have you. He has also been involved with this project, but Tilly has very much been the lead on this. And what she's created for us, or rather recreated for us, in flat 130, which has its own interesting history, I'll talk a little bit more about in a moment, but she's recreated an interior as though it were 1968. This is the moment when people had just moved in. So we've got bits of furniture from, you know, the 40s and 50s, and then new bits that they might have managed to get hold of dating from the 1960s as well.
We pass down a corridor with a marvellous view further east through large windows, and between marks from people working on the building, the engineers, that show signs perhaps of concrete death, which sounds pretty alarming given that we're up on top of all that dead concrete. We'll maybe return to that, but we're in the flat now. A mirror from the first half of the 20th century hangs on the wall. Still a bit of flooring to go down, I think. And here we are. We're in 1968.
That's absolutely right. Now, I mentioned just a moment ago that this flat has its own really important history. What I was alluding to is the fact that this is the flat that Goldfinger and his wife moved into in 1968 for 2 months to test out the building. So Goldfinger was so committed to this idea of creating really well-designed housing for ordinary people that he felt, having created this extraordinary building, that he had to come and test it. He knew that he had other commissions on the way. He knew that he had Carradale House still to build. He knew that he had Glenkerry. He knew that he had Trellick Tower in North Kensington as well. And so he wanted to come and actually spend time here, really understanding what it was like to be a resident, trying to get to grips with all of the issues, all of the different problems. And, of course, he does go on and make design changes in places later. Trellick Tower, perhaps most notably, has three lifts rather than two, because, of course, the moment one lift is out of action or someone is moving in or out, you know, moving lots of furniture.
Which is all the time in a building like this.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, it becomes a real problem. You're just standing there waiting for one lift to take you up and down 27 floors.
Well, as somebody who's visited his place over in Hampstead, I can see straight away a Goldfinger signature move here, which is a clever little cupboard at the top of the stairs. They're very neatly dropped in, very discreet. But I wonder what else I might see here that would remind me of that other building.
Lots of nice little design features. You're absolutely right. No element of space is wasted. Other particular things, as I mentioned earlier, the glazing, the very fact that this flat feels so light is really extraordinary. And also thinking, we'll come into the bathroom and the kitchen a little bit later, but beautiful signature moments like very beautifully designed taps and you know, very nice fitted kitchen furniture and things like that that absolutely speak in every way of Goldfinger.
Well, we're looking forward to that. We have only one thing between us and that, which is a word from our sponsor.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and I am up in the sky with Tilly Hemingway. And Joe Watson is lurking in the background, but he has to lurk a little bit because it's quite a compact place that we're in here, and you need to be able to make good use of space, don't you? I notice, for a start, that everything's white, which is a pretty sound move if you're trying to make things feel a little bigger, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, when we moved in, well, when we got access to the flat, it was certainly wasn't white, but it also wasn't in its original state from 1968. It'd definitely been slightly bastardised over the years. Had some really, really bad 90s carpet down and also some really bad 90s wallpaper. And unfortunately, previous tenants had painted over a few original features, which is a shame. So we've done our best to kind of bring it back to how it might have looked in 1968. So we're in the living room now with views over the River Thames, and you can didn't realise how close Greenwich was, actually. It's really, really close. You've got amazing, amazing views over Greenwich. So the residents would have had a really nice, quite generously sized balcony with a nice little planter, which we're planting up with traditional 60s plants now, quite kitsch, peonies and nice pink flowers. So moving in, what we're standing in now, we're in the living room. And what I've tried to do is get as much British designed and manufactured furniture as possible in here. We've got a three-piece sofa suite and coffee table, which is designed by Guy Rogers in 1966. It's even got the stamp, 1966 stamp on it, which is really nice. We've got the teak ladder axe behind us here, which is by Staples, who are based in Middlesex, and they're still about, actually. They're over in Middlesex still.
There was a word you used in that sentence I didn't understand.
Ladder axe. So it's, I guess it's the freestanding wall storage. So they're, I mean, normally you have the kind of metal legs and frame, but this is really nice. It's all solid teak.
So you've got slatted...
Really, really nice one. It's kind of, yeah,
slatted teak bars
slatted
there.
Slatted teak legs, and then you clip in metal rods, and on top of that it's kind of modular, so you decide how it looks, really. So we've got units with sliding doors, you've got the drawers, you've got drop down desk, and you can decide where these go, and kind of you buy the pieces and slot it together how
you
wish.
Sounds very 60s
very
cutting
nice.
Edge
yeah very, it is very nice. In fact, I'd quite like this for my house after this project's done.
Are you given an enormous budget with which to furnish this place?
It definitely wasn't enormous. I mean, we had to be quite clever, really, with where we found the stuff from. So, you know, we got to auction sites and antique markets and car boot sales. And you can obviously still find, I mean, people have kept onto this kind of stuff for years, and you can be lucky and find some really amazing things.
But this is where your expertise really comes into its own, because you've got to know what you're looking at under those circumstances.
You've got to know where stuff's from as well. I mean, the difficulty with this, it's, you know, it's been a working class family that lived here, so you've got to kind of do a balance of getting things that look nice and that people will be wowed when they come and see it, but also you've got to remember that this wasn't, you know, designer. It really wasn't designers or people with a lot of money that would have lived here. So I've got a real good mix here, I think, of what a kind of, you know, traditional East End family might have, how they might have lived.
Well, I was struck by something, and you often see it in films. So let's say you've got a film set in 1960 and there's cars driving around in the film.
Yeah.
And all the cars are from 1960. And of course, when you look at a photograph from that time, actually most of the cars are from about 1940. Mm-hmm. And very few of them are modern. So have you tried to incorporate older stuff, as would have happened?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it's a working class family that lived here, and they wouldn't have moved here and bought absolutely everything new. They couldn't afford to have done that. So we've got a lot of stuff from the 50s in here as well. So we've got an old TV, old lampshades, old sewing machine. It's kind of stuff that people would have collected over the years. We've got G-plan nesting tables, which probably would have been made perhaps early 60s. They certainly wouldn't have been late 60s. And the same throughout the rest of the flat, the dining table and chairs in the kitchen, possibly late 50s, early 60s. So not everything is from 1968. I mean, people you couldn't afford to buy everything new, so it had been stuff that had been accumulated over the years.
You're, I guess, putting your twist on things as well to some degree. I can see the degree of historical accuracy. Yeah. How much license do you allow yourself?
A little bit. I've kind of played, I've got a story in my head, I guess. I've got, over in the corner there, we've got a tulip table and chairs, you know, the white typical 60s style dining table and chairs, and the family that lived here probably wouldn't have been able to afford that. So I've played it in my head that it's a it's second hand. She got it cheap because it was a display model, and it should really have four chairs, but I've only got three, so that was the deal. She got it cheap because a full set's not there. But I think, you know, the flat, I felt like it needed items like this to really give the impression of the 60s and add that wow as well for the visitors.
We are standing on an enormous sheepskin effect rug, which takes up most of the floor. And I wondered, given the interior design and decoration touches, where we can see touches added by Goldfinger himself.
Yeah, I mean, this rug isn't from the 60s. I mean, every other rug.
What?
I know. Every other rug in the flat is from the 60s, but this one isn't. It's 3.5 metres by 2.5 metres wide. And I think one of the things we struggled with was where different flooring had been laid down over the years and then ripped up. A lot of the tiles are damaged, they've got paint splashed all over them, and we've done our best to clean them up, but in some cases it was impossible. And then to find a rug which kind of was big enough to cover it, and it's really hard to find nice 60s big rugs. I mean, you get
they're
a lot
going to be in terrible shape by now.
Yeah, well, they're either in really bad shape or loads of them. There's loads of them over in America and Germany, but they go for £8,000-9,000, some of them, the kind of Pantone era style rugs, and that would have been the whole budget blown on a rug, so that wasn't a possibility. So I think this is pretty good. I mean, it looks 60s, isn't it? It's nice and shaggy, and I think we've done our best with elements like that.
I can see that either you've had an eye for the authenticating details here. We see, for example, a pipe, a tobacco pipe, resting on top of what I'm sure is a period newspaper.
Yeah.
Or you've just been doing no work at all and entertaining yourselves, because there is a game called Careers, which seems to be mid-play at the moment. I don't know really what you and your colleagues are up to. But should we move out of the lounge and see what else we can see?
Go into the kitchen.
The kitchen, yeah. I see what you mean about the flooring, by the way. That's really taken a beating.
It really has taken a beating, and especially obviously in the bathroom and toilet, as you can see here, it's non-existent. So we're having, I mean, we've got someone coming in later to lay down some lino, which is, we've got a nice grey fleck lino going in the bathroom and toilet, which is, you know, it looks very 60s, it's certainly of the era. And then out on the stairs and in the lobby, where they're really, really, really damaged on the stairs, we've got lino tiles coming, which are as close a match to the colour of the tiles as we could get, rather than, you know, sticking down something which wouldn't have been. We're trying to replicate it as best we can, really.
Given what we've said about the, I'm going to say, and it's probably controversial, but kind of social decline of the buildings of this sort. Mm-hmm. Joe and I were talking a little bit about the idea of ghettoisation, yeah, essentially. Was there much in the way of domestic pride within the individual flats, as far as you can ascertain? Were people taking care of their homes?
Do you mean the people who were probably last in here before I came in?
Well, I suppose if you can see the general state of it, do you detect that people have looked after it, or have people seen it as temporary, do you think? Or,
I mean, it's hard to say, really. I'm sure when people first moved in, they took a hell of a lot of pride. They would have loved living here, because, as I say, it was utopian. They would have had, you know, a kitchen, you know, that worked, and a separate toilet and bathroom, and their own entrance, and it was a nice maisonette. But I think over the years it probably hasn't been looked after as it should and could have been. You know, it's unfair to say that the people who lived here last, you know, were disrespectful with it, or let it get into a bad state. But it was I have to say, it wasn't in the best of states when we came in. It was pretty dirty. There was quite a bit of mould in the bedrooms as well.
Oh, in the bedrooms?
In the bedrooms, yeah, in the kids' bedrooms as well, which wasn't the best. And the kitchen where the cooker had been, it looked like it hadn't been cleaned for 10 years. I'm not exaggerating with that one. The decorator was actually, I came to see how they were doing one day, and they'd been under the sink because there was a blockage in the pipe, so they'd been trying to sort it out. And he said he unblocked it, and the stuff that came out, a 50-year-old bloke, quite hardy, and he said he ran to the toilet and was just retching over the toilet. So it wasn't in the best of states when we got hold of it. But that's not to say they didn't enjoy living here. I mean, there was no. But the thing is, I was in one of the kids' bedrooms taking pictures when I first came round, and one of the kids had written a really sweet little message on the wall in pen, just on.
Oh, I thought you were going to say use their finger in the mould.
No, they hadn't. They'd written a nice little a message on the wall, and it said bye bye Barathon Tower, I'll miss you. It was really sad. I thought it was really, really lovely. I took a picture of it. So they obviously liked living here, and it was home to them. So,
have you had much interaction, both of you, with the other residents? Have they been curious what's going on in this particular apartment?
I don't know how many original residents still. I know there's one guy, but we've not. There's definitely one man who's lived here from the very start. I mean, I've not spoken to him or been introduced to him, so I'm not sure which flat he lives in. But he's obviously been here for, how many years is it? What are we in? 46 years? And he must have loved it if he's still here. I've spoken to, you know, residents who are more, who've not lived here as long, and they absolutely love it as well. So, I mean, and I'd love to live here. This would be I love brutalist architecture, so I'd absolutely love to live here. And the views are just incredible. The views you get over London are probably... they're probably the best views of London I've seen, especially at night or just as it's going dark. It's just, you just want to stand and look out the window for hours.
Joe, given that Tilly has decorated the place and invested a lot of time and care into the place, is there any chance of just handing it over to her?
I wish we could. Alas, the building is due to... well, not alas. It's a very good thing that the building is due to be completely refurbished in the coming couple of years. So, in fact, most of the residents at the moment are artists, and they have art studios here provided...
That's always the precursor to renovation.
I'm afraid it is. But it's a good thing, really. And, as I say... lots of artists here at the moment because of the Beaux Arts Trust and a brilliant partnership between the Beaux Arts Trust and Poplar Harker, which has allowed artists to move in, use the spaces, and in some cases open their spaces as well, which I think has been a really good thing. I think that's since 2008. So it's seen the building certainly become a more creative place over the last few years.
Hmm. Perhaps it's a good moment to talk about the National Trust's involvement as well. And I know that in any city, and with the wealth of city properties, it must be pretty fierce competition for some sort of special attention. What is it about this place that set it above all the other contenders, I wonder?
Well, perhaps it was always a logical first foray into brutalism for the National Trust because of our connection with Number 2 Willow Road. So, of course, there was that wonderful Goldfinger connection, and we found ourselves thinking, if we were to open somewhere, where would it be? Well, of course, Balfron and Trellick were very high on the list. I mean, actually, the inception of the project, it came out of a conference, an Iconic Houses conference, about a year ago now, which was exploring 20th century housing, and it was exploring 20th century houses which are open to the public. So it was a day, really, looking at some of the most famous houses around the world which are open to the public. What gradually became clear, though, was that there was no example anywhere in among all of those wonderful houses of social housing. And the challenge came out really at the end of the conference that, you know, if anyone was going to do it, well, it would have to be the National Trust. And a sense of people really lending their support that they would lend help if we could find a way of making it happen. So we came away from that conference and we thought, well, let's see if we can. Now... in an ideal world, of course, we'd be able to take over this flat forever in perpetuity, like we do with lots of our places. We don't have that opportunity, and nor would we want to take away this house, you know, as social housing. That's what it has been, and that's important. But we did have the opportunity granted to us by Poplar Harker and the Beaux Arts Trust to open this place for a period of 2 weeks to recreate it, you know, to be in this space and to have Tilly and the Hemingway come in and do the extraordinary work that they've done, and we leapt at the opportunity. Of course, we had to, and we think it's a very exciting project.
And that's at odds, I suppose, with the permanence of the ideals behind the structure and the longevity of the structure itself. Just a couple of weeks, and then all of this is whisked away, and we know exactly where some of that furniture is going to end up, don't we, Tilly?
Well, yeah, I might have to. Well, to be honest, we've lent quite a lot of our personal collection as well, and we also we co-own a museum down in Shropshire. So a lot of the kind of the smaller items, like all the old food packaging and stuff in the bathroom and the magazines and newspapers that you talked about, and the games, they all come from that museum. So they all go back there.
So this is a really happy relationship in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and then also a lot of the stuff that we've purchased we will be auctioning off as well, so people that look around can bid on most of the items that are here as well.
Very good. We've got just a couple of minutes left. Unfortunately, we could spend a lot longer. But what I'd really love, just in the closing moments, is to see what makes this a Goldfinger-designed dwelling.
Let's see.
I'm being led into the really quite spacious kitchen, which has been decked out in definitely Mad Men-era kitchen equipment.
I think there's, as Joe's already mentioned, I think it's all the small details, like, you know, absolutely beautifully designed taps and the integrated kitchen with the really nice handles. And then you've also got the light switches as well outside all the doors. They're all beautiful. I mean, not all of them were here when we got hold of the flat, but we've managed to nip into other flats in the building which are empty and pinch their light switches so we could get the original ones in.
What makes these, and looking at them now, of course, they look like the sort of thing to my eye that's due to be replaced, but what is it that makes them exciting for you?
I don't know. They're just so simple and clean looking, and they feel solid as well. They're not, you know, they're not PVC. Everything nowadays is PVC, and it, you know, this feels like it's built to last, and it obviously has lasted. And I feel like a lot of things that are built nowadays don't feel like they're going to last that long, and don't feel like they'll be in as a good nick as this is in 50 years' time.
I do remember in Willow Road there was a use of wood and metal which seemed somehow surprising, although I couldn't quite put my finger on what was so unusual about it, but it did seem as though the principles that were being applied there, those big windows as well, have been translated to this entirely different property really quite easily.
I think that's absolutely right. Goldfinger was probably obsessive about materials. We know from Willow Road that, you know, he was sort of obsessively designing things like door handles all of the time because he wanted it to feel like it was the perfect grip on your hand, you know, so that it didn't jar in any way. And as I say, he was obsessed with the use of different materials, with both contemporary materials but also those materials that had stood the test of time. And so you do get these wonderful uses of you know, materials like wood and metal, but, you know, set against the contrast of what would at that point have been quite exciting use of concrete as well.
Which brings me, I didn't know we were going to squeeze this in, but concrete death you mentioned on the way up. What on earth is concrete death?
Well, concrete death, I'm afraid, is much discussed by architects, and I'm not sure that even architects are quite sure exactly what it is, but it is the process that concrete goes through as it ages, and in certain places concrete can crack, and then it can also become very waterlogged, and that is what is commonly referred to as concrete death.
So it's, that's why the engineers are checking to see whether the building's shifting around and falling apart?
That's right. Thankfully, it seems safe at the moment.
Yeah, I'm 27 floors up, and I can't wait to be on the ground. So, without further ado, we should say, actually, the place is open for 2 weeks. What sort of chance are people got of getting in here?
They have still got a chance, so tickets are still available. They are £12 a pop, and we're open from Wednesday to Sunday from the 1st of October until the 12th of October.
So you need to get your skates on, but it's well worth a visit, if only for the view, but also for the excellent recreation of the 60s environment and for this fleeting opportunity to see Goldfinger's work from the inside. Tilly Hemingway, Joe Watson, thanks very much for today.
Thank you.
Thank you. My heart aches for some
far off days, no one cut it. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Tilly Hemingway and Joe Watson. Thanks too to Mark Barr and Bernie Barkley. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm in Quentin Wolfe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.